Good morning. How's the pollen treating everybody? Yeah. What'd you say? It's not neglecting you, giving you all the attention you could ever ask for? You're good. Well, it's good to be with you this morning, and we are in Revelation, and we are in chapter 1. We're going to just peek into the first five verses of chapter 22, and that's the final chapter. So we've rounded the corner, and I can see the finish line. Good Lord willing, we will cross the finish line a week from today for our final sermon in chapter 22. But we've come to the chapter that is filled with visions and symbolism regarding what is to come, the world to come, the new heavens and the new earth. And I've adopted D.A. Carson's approach to understanding and tackling this difficult topic, but filled with hope. And that is, he looks at what John says. He looks what's written in these chapters, and he asks four questions in order to help us understand, well, what will the newness look like? How will it affect us? And he asks the question, first of all, what's new? And what's symbolic? What's missing? And then what's central as we wrestle with these new concepts of the new heavens and the new earth. And so it's been a little while. We had Easter Sunday, and then we had Communion Sunday. It's been a little while, but the first question has already been answered in the first eight verses of this chapter. And last time we looked at what is new about heaven. And the first thing we found is that there's no sea. And it's not the idea that, wow, well, there's no sea in heaven. Why would I want to go there? I'm a beach lover. It's the idea of what the sea represents to the Jewish people, and that is it represents chaos. It represents storms and disaster. And the idea to say that there's no sea is in the sense to say there's no storms, there's no darkness, there's no looming dark clouds that are headed your way that will wipe you out. Second, we were introduced to the idea of the holy city. That's also something that's new. But as we began to look at how John described the New Jerusalem or the holy city, he used lots of different terms. And in the end, as we looked at, not only is it the holy city, but he also calls it the new heavens and the new earth, and he also calls it the bride. We'll see a little bit of that today. The idea is that all three of these metaphors are, it takes all three of these concepts to really understand the scope of what awaits us in the new heavens and the new earth. Just one description won't do. So John uses more depictions of what the heavens and the earth will be like in order to capture all that awaits us. The main emphasis as we looked at this and we considered what does it mean when describing a holy city or the New Jerusalem, and then what aspect does the idea of the bride or the wife of Christ come into play when we think about the new heavens. And the final conclusion, I think, of what the Lord would have us to land on, or that which is emphasized the most, is that this is a dwelling place of God. The thing that we are to be the most excited about, longing for the most, is that we get to dwell with the living God. And so that's what should capture our excitement and our attention the most of all of these things. We get the new place, we get the new environment, the new surroundings, the new sounds, we get our new bodies. There's a lot of wonderful things, and we're going to look at descriptions today. And there's wonderful things about heaven that will delight us. But the most delightful thing, I think, that the Scripture wants to depict about the heavens is that we get to dwell with a living God. And that's astounding. If we understand the value and the worth, the character, the holiness of God, that just to be in His presence with no veils and no cloudiness is the crown jewel of heaven. And that's what we want to take away. And we also looked at the idea of the New Jerusalem being the bride of Christ. And the concept there is that to dwell in the presence of God, we will have this new level of intimacy. And God uses marriage as a show and tell of His love and His desire to be one with His people. And as you know, in a marriage, when it's done right, when you think of the most perfect example of it, it's wonderful communication, wonderful intimacy. You're there for each other. It's like the safest place, the safest relationship that you have. You share all your concerns, your burdens. You're there to help each other through everything. And that is the concept and the relationship that we will have with the living God in heaven. It's this new level here. So it's the conceivable, best possible relationship ever that humanity can have with their God. That's what awaits us. So let's look at the next question here. Not what's new, but what's symbolic. I'm going to look at verses 9 through 21. Then came one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues and spoke to me, saying, "Come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb." And he carried me away in the spirit to a great high mountain. And he showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, having the glory of God, its radiance like a most rare jewel, like a jasper, clear as crystal. It had a great high wall with 12 gates, and at the gates 12 angels, and on the gates the names of the 12 tribes of the sons of Israel were inscribed. On the east 3 gates, on the north 3 gates, on the south 3 gates, and on the west 3 gates. And the wall of the city had 12 foundations, and on them were the 12 names, the 12 apostles of the Lamb. And the one who spoke with me had a measuring rod of gold to measure the city and its gates and walls. The city lies 4 square, its length the same as its width. And he measured the city with his rod, 12,000 stadia. Its length and width and height are equal. He also measured its wall, 144 cubits by human measurement, which is also an angel's measurement, in case you didn't know that. The wall was built of jasper, while the city was pure gold like clear glass. The foundations of the wall of the city were adorned with every kind of jewel. The first was jasper, the second sapphire, the third agate, the fourth emerald, the fifth onyx, the sixth carnelian, the seventh chrysolite, the eighth beryl, the ninth topaz, the tenth chrysoprase, never heard of that one, the 11th jacinth, and the 12th amethyst. And the 12 gates were 12 pearls, each of the gates made of a single pearl. And the street of the city was pure gold, like transparent glass. Somebody's happy back there. So you read that, and if you ask the question, what's symbolic? Well, what isn't, almost? I mean, you have these descriptions, but in this book we have, it's the type of literature, apocalyptic literature, that employs specifically the style of symbolism in helping us understand and grasp the main ideas here. So symbolism is unavoidable. And keep in mind, I know symbolism for us, because we're not really that used to it, it can be frustrating, and I know sometimes it's frustrating to me. But in all honesty, there are things that we can read, and we don't understand all the details. We're not meant to. That's not the point. But you can walk away still having a wonderful idea, and perhaps an even better idea, of what heaven is like than if we were to use actual descriptions, because we haven't been there anyway. So actual descriptions aren't going to do us but so good in and of themselves. This passage, I think, is particularly symbolic. In verses 9 and 10, the angel tells John that he'll show him the bride, which is also called the wife, and he takes him to this very high mountain. I guess the idea is you need to come up here in order to get a better view of what I want to show you. And he takes him up there and to see the bride, the wife, and what does he see? Not the bride and the wife, he sees the holy city. So you see the mixture of metaphors here. And it takes these descriptions in order us to understand the scope of it. So all of these things, in a sense, they're different, but they're the same because they communicate a fuller appreciation of the things to come. The bride, in a sense, when you're looking at the bride, you're seeing the new city. You're looking at the new city, you're seeing the bride as well. By the way, you could employ that same reasoning by, well, who's the groom? Who's the husband of the bride? Well, it's the Lamb. He's the Lamb, he's the Lion, he's Christ. He's all of those things. He's each of those things. But we have these different descriptions in order for us to grasp the scope of what we're dealing with, who God is and what the New Jerusalem is like. So we think about symbolism. The same goes for the mountain. The angel takes John to a mountain. Apparently that's higher than other mountains, so you can get the best kind of view. And again, sometimes we might be tempted to think, well, what mountain was it? You know, what mountain is so high that you could see the new city? Is it even in any of the states here in this world or in this country? Is it in any of the countries, or is it a mountain in another universe, another dimension? What are we talking about here? I don't think the point is for us to fixate on the actual mountain, but it's the idea of you need to be up here to get a better view so that you can see things as God sees them. I think it's kind of like when, to get back into the Gospels, to get out of heaven for a second in the visions, but get back to the Gospels, you'll remember, and we're getting ready to tackle this in Mark, where Jesus was led out into the wilderness to be tempted, and the devil tempted him. And one of the ways that he tempted him was that he took him up to a high mountain, and he showed him all the kingdoms of the world, of the earth. So from this standpoint on this mountain, you can see all the kingdoms of the earth. And Jesus, of course, rejected that temptation. He did not want to, he wasn't tempted by the power to rule. He already had that. But sometimes we might get fixated on, well, what mountain was that? What mountain did Satan bring Jesus to so that he could get the view of all the kingdoms? Is there even such a mountain that exists? Well, the early Christians decided there was. And they actually built a monastery on it, 4th century Christians. I think they call it the Mount of Temptation. But to me, that misses the point. Because I don't know what mountain Jesus was taken to, but I know exactly what God is trying to communicate in that story. I know the intensity of the temptation. And from whatever he was, or if it was a vision, whatever happened there, the point is Jesus was tempted in real life, and he resisted that temptation. So without getting all the details and the geography and the places and trying to map out the elevations of all the mountains in the world where he possibly could have gone, we still get the idea of what was entailed. And that's what we're wrestling with here in this book. I don't know that there is a mountain that would give us a panoramic of all the kingdoms of the world. But we know what the devil was up to, and we saw the power of Christ to resist it. Another thing we have in here in symbolic terms, how do you describe the glory of God? I mean, like, we know, we've read enough in Scripture about it. It's wonderful, it's warm, it's bright. Moses had to veil his face because just a partial of the backside of God. He had this little vision. But how do you explain that? Like, how do you wrap do you turn bright lights on? How do you wrap your mind around it? Well, Revelation gives us all kinds of symbolism. Having the glory of God, its radiance like a most rare jewel. So it goes to a sparkly thing, shiny things, absolutely beautiful things that take on different beauty, even in different light and shades and cuts and so forth, like jasper, clear as crystal. So you can see it, but yet it's still clear. And the idea is just it's bright, it's radiant, it's shiny, it draws you in, it captures your attention. That's the glory of God. You won't be able to take your eyes off of it. You won't be able to take your eyes or move your eyes away because you've never seen something so wonderful and something so beautiful. It's alluring, it's powerful, shimmering, sparkly, like precious jewels. And then John sees a wall with 12 gates, and with each gate there's an angel. Now the idea of the 12 gates, I think, is like you just have this, you can get to the city from any direction. It's the idea of access to God. You have access to God with all these gates. You don't have these long lines behind each gate from every direction there. And they represent the 12 tribes and the 12 apostles. Again, that's the, which multiplied, you have the 144,000 that we talked about earlier in the book of Revelation. So it's full access. Who has full access? All of God's people, Old Testament saints, New Testament saints, all of the redeemed have full access and can enter the gate to spend time with the Lord. And they're from all nations. It's the representation of God. Christ came after all nations, all tribes, all people, all tongues, all of humanity is represented in heaven as being redeemed by the blood of Christ as the gospel goes out and the unreached people are reached. And that's God's vision. That's the beauty of heaven. It's not just the jewels, but it's also the people that God has redeemed. God, we are created in God's image. We are beautiful in His sight. And He called us up to be with Him, all the nations of the earth. It's interesting that in this city, symbolically, you see the apostles not only representing the gates, but the foundation of this city. And in what way are the apostles symbolically, how was the church or any city built upon the apostles? Well, the Apostle Paul, helps us understand that in Ephesians 2, 19 through 20. He says, "So then you are no longer strangers and aliens, but you are fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God, built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets. Christ Jesus Himself being the cornerstone." And you would kind of, like I would have expected that Christ is the foundation. So in what way are the apostles? Well, it's the message that Christ gave them. They were the inspired ones. He revealed Himself to the world through the apostles. The message, the good news, came through the apostles. They were a uniquely anointed group of men. And as people believed in the message of Christ, the revelation that they proclaimed, well, there's the church of God being built. That's heaven. Those are future citizens of heaven. And it's in that way that they serve as a foundation, of course, with Christ being the cornerstone as well. So you have one and the other there. This city has walls and gates and gatekeepers. And you think, well, why? What are the walls there for? And why are angels stationed at the gates? Is there fear of danger? Like, what is there to guard against if there's no evil in heaven? There's nobody scheming how to break through the walls or how to shoot their projectiles or the missiles over the walls. And the idea is exactly the opposite, is that there is no evil to be pushed away or to be guarded there. It's, you are perfectly safe. You have walls, you're enveloped in the presence of God. You're safe from, if you ever felt anything that would make you feel unsafe, it doesn't exist there because there's no enemy to ward off in heaven. So it actually communicates to us complete safety. I mean, I guess you could say it's like having the best security system. Not that you need it, but just so you can feel safe, you have the best security system there. You don't have to have that feeling of uncertainty. What will the world be like when I wake up in the morning? No more danger here. Even the internet is secure in heaven. Cybersecurity. You don't have to worry about your identity being stolen. That happens. or things being hacked. People get your private and personal information, and it's unnerving. And I would like to think, and I'm just believing this is the case, no more bad internet in heaven. Because I live in this little place, this little internet hole, where it just doesn't quite reach me. And it's all around me. And so I get to watch my computer spin and wait and wait and wait. And as one who doesn't have a lot of patience, you can imagine. But so it's a wonderful place that awaits us in heaven. Then we have all these measurements. And I think those measurements are symbolic as well in verses 15 through 17. You know, numbers are important, and a lot of times what they add up to, you know, the 12 and the 12, the 144K, that's the idea of completeness. So there's this fullness. Heaven represents not just the full presence of God, but everybody that is intended to be there will be there. It's just like everything comes into play. Everything fits perfectly as it was designed to do. Also, when you add up these measurements, course you get a perfect cube. And what's the only thing in Scripture? There's only one thing in the entire Bible that is described or measured in this way to be a perfect cube. And that is, all the way in the Old Testament, the Holy of Holies, when God instructed them to build the tent or the tabernacle. The Holy of Holies was the only thing that is an actual perfect cube. And of course, that represents the dwelling place of God. So the city is the dwelling place of God. He manifests himself there. Not just in one little part of it, but the entire city is a manifestation of the new order of Christ. It's the whole thing, not just parts of it or places where the sun shines. And that's what's supposed to wow us about heaven, is that God is everywhere. And it's hard to wrap our minds around this idea because we're so used to separation. We're so used to limited access to these things. And heaven is like this big announcement that of God, I will be with you and dwell with you fully. You have full access to me. In addition, we also know that the 12 times 12 represents the 144, the perfect symmetry of his elect. And if you take it literally, this cube, you will have a city that's 1,400 miles in every direction, the cube. That means also straight up. That's pretty high. That's three times higher than the highest skyscraper in Abu Dhabi. This is up there above where the birds fly. It's basically in outer space here. That's how high the city, if you would want to take it literally there. That's nosebleed territory. But I don't think that that's the point, that, well, how would you even get up there? What's the use of the city being so high? By the way, the walls are only 200 feet there. But it's the symbolism that is important. It's the vastness. It's how big and how full the presence of God is just bursting there. All the details, jasper, gold, they communicate God's exquisite glory, his brilliance, his beauty. And it's everywhere you look. And it's so interesting that Scripture goes to great detail to show us how we cannot look at God and live. If you see God, you die. And when Moses said, I want to see you, and God said, you can't see me, but I'll give you just barely a glimpse. And even that resulted in Moses' face just radiating. It had this effect in space and time. People couldn't even look at that reflection. And yet, you're in this heaven where everything that's there just reflects the radiance and the glory of God. So it's symbolic of something wonderful, beautiful, precious, warm, and safe. What's missing? 22 through 27. I saw no temple in the city, for its temple is the Lord God, the Almighty, and the Lamb. There's all these metaphors again, right? And the city has no need of sun or moon to shine on it, for the glory of God gives it light, and its lamp is the Lamb. By its light will the nations walk, and the kings of the earth will bring their glory into it. And its gates will never be shut by day, and there will be no night there. They will bring into it the glory and the honor of the nations. But nothing unclean will ever enter it, nor anyone who does what is detestable or false, but only those who are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. No temple in this. Why would there not be a temple in the heavens? There's no need of a temple. You have the real thing. You have God. You worship Him in freedom. You worship Him with full access. The whole city is the temple. That's kind of the idea. It's not so much that there is no temple, but it's that the whole city serves as the temple. And what does the temple represent? The temple represents the manifestation of the closeness of God and His people. That's how God dwells with His people in this world, in this earth. He instructed them to design a temple, and then there was a specific place that He dwelt with His people in that temple. But it was a limited access. It took a lot to be in the presence of God in that day. It could mean death if you were not properly prepared to be in His presence. So in this world, it's like you, if you get close to Him, you may not escape with your life. And in that world to come, you cannot escape Him. There's nowhere you can go, not that you would want to, but there's just nowhere you can go where God will not be fully present. You see the antithesis of what we experience here. And I think the idea is if we just let our sanctified imaginations go, is that it's to get us excited. It's to get us excited about another place that's real, that exists, that awaits for us. To get us so excited that we will begin to long for it more than we long for the things of this world. Because these things pale in comparison. And so really, and we'll close this way, I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit here, but understanding heaven is also a part of our hearts. It's aligning our hearts with what's truly beautiful. What should our hearts truly long for? If they don't long for beauty and righteousness and holiness and relationship as God longs for it, then something's wrong with them. If we don't get more excited about being in the presence of God than any other new thing in heaven, then something is still off. And may God forgive us and continue to sanctify us and help us to think clearly and to feel clearly about what He has planned and has in store for us. When we leave this earth, we go to a way better place that takes symbolism to describe it. It's so awesome for us. When you long for something so much in this world, you begin to do whatever it takes to get it. It's a kind of a slogan sometimes. Whatever it takes. Why whatever it takes? Because you want this thing so bad. And I think the idea of John or God giving us these visions and these glimpses is that a longing will be created to be with this God in a way so that whatever it takes, whatever God has for me, whatever I have to go through, whatever I have to renounce, I will do it because that's what I want. That's the pearl of great price. Revelation wants to hone our minds in the things that we understand and value the most. So there's a sense in which it's revealing our hearts. It's revealing what we love and what we long for, what we settle for. So we are to be get excited about our future here. What else is missing? No sun or moon. We just saw an eclipse. We saw them both, the sun and the moon. There's no sun or moon. Why? You don't need it. They were created as luminaries, night and day. When you have the glory of God, God is light. In Him there is no darkness. I mean, you can try to figure out the astronomical calculations to how that's possible if you want. I don't want to. But you just have the glory of God there. And he is light. You can't escape the light in this new place. And of course, that plays along with the whole idea of how darkness is used sometimes. Now, darkness is good in the sense that we get to rest and things settle down. But it's also used to depict evil. You know, evil lurks. It hides in the darkness. It wants to sneak around where it can't be seen. Darkness is a dangerous time. That's when a lot of the crime happens. That's where you're more likely to get mugged or robbed. Things happen in the night and the darkness. But here, there is no darkness. Everything is illuminated by the light of God. Darkness is swallowed up. So the creeps aren't going to come out at night in heaven. You don't have to lock your doors there. You don't close up shop. You don't have to worry about who's behind me. What are those footsteps that are walking behind me here? You don't have to worry about being attacked because that darkness is a symbolism of evil. But it's now, it's just unmitigated goodness. It's nothing but one good thing after another. Gates are never closed. Your life is, and your soul, your spirit, there's nothing at risk. There's nothing to be afraid of. There's no danger. There's nothing unclean. There's no scheming going on behind your back. All of that has been eradicated by the work and the blood of Christ. Nothing deceitful. Just all of God's creatures will robustly thrive in every way imagined. Every creature there will only worship God with full hearts. There's none of this split, duplicity or split allegiance. It's like this is a place where full out worship and honor goes to God from every creature in heaven. God will only be honored. In heaven, we will only be honored because all that are there have full hearts for God. They see God's law and word. And they understand righteousness. And that's all we'll want to do to every living thing and for each other is to exhibit righteousness there. We'll never be cheated on. We'll never be lied about. We'll never be gossiped about. All these things that just tear away at the joy of our lives. Here, no one will ever covet what we have. It will just be, everyone will love God with their full hearts. And we will love our neighbors as ourselves. God's vision of humanity will be fulfilled and then some. And in a sense, heaven is describing what our hearts should long for. And I think every human heart in one way or another longs for these things. Why do we cheer at movies where good triumphs over evil? Because we don't like to be beaten up. We don't like to be made fun of. We don't like to be oppressed and pushed down. We like that hero figure that saves us from all of these things that terrify us about this life. And that's what awaits us in heaven. And it just builds and builds and builds so that we long for it. So just to be clear, the point of all of this is not so much that it's new and it's like it's beautiful, but all of that plays into the whole picture of the God who is there. We will experience the love of God. What does it mean to be loved by God? We do not fully yet know. But there's been times where the love of God has just manifested itself upon me in ways that floors me. And I think in heaven, that will never stop. That will flow. And you will not want to leave it. Everything that we thought we loved in this world will just like all of a sudden, it didn't even matter. The things that we were trying to attain and maybe compromising ourselves over, they just will not even matter. And one more thing before moving on in verse 24. By its light will the nations walk, and the kings of the earth will bring their glory into it, and its gates will never be shut by day, and there will be no night there. Again, there's the emphasis of access. Nothing is shut off. Nothing is separated. And there's no darkness. they will bring into it the glory and the honor of the nations. So how do you bring glory into a place that's already filled with glory? And the idea here is that there are people, the people of the earth, the kings of the earth, have been given certain honors and privileges by God to serve Him in ways. They have wielded headship and rulership and powers. And what they do is they come, and whatever honor that they were given in this earth, they give it back to God. And it reminds me of in the early verses of Revelation, where you had the angels and the elders falling before the Lord, and they were giving Him their crowns. And what is the significance of that? Well, if you've been given a crown, that means you were some kind of potentate. You were some kind of ruler. You had clout, if you will, in this world. But when you come into the holy place before a holy God, anything that you had, you are so humbled that you are even able to have this status or clout or power to exercise. You just throw yourself and you throw whatever glory you had at the feet of Christ, He who is more glorious. Isn't that a beautiful picture? I mean, you have the most powerful figures, and God gives people power in this earth. He does. And there are awesome people that are models to us. And yet all of the power and all of the savvy ways that they had about them and the allure that they had, they just come and they just, here, you gave me this, I give it back to you. I just want to use it as one more thing to give to you, to offer you, because I want to give you my all. What a beautiful picture of what takes place in heaven. Whatever God gifts us, whatever greatness we may have attained or acquired, We don't hold it on like, no, this is mine and you can't have it. It's like you just want to give it to God because He is so worthy and you're so grateful that you were even used by Him in any kind of way in this world. So as you see, everything just continues from beginning to end in Revelation. It continues to center around God. We open with the throne room as the command center of the entire universe. Nothing happens in this universe that doesn't pass through the command center. And it's still that way. God is the center here. And symbols serve God often, I think, better in this case. Because you can see even more clearly what happens and the significance of each thing. Whereas if we tried to use perhaps literal language, we would be lacking. And then lastly, we kind of already had been leading up to this, what's central? We're going to sneak into chapter 22 here, first five verses. Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb through the middle of the street of the city. Also on either side of the river, the tree of life with its 12 kinds of fruit, yielding its fruit each month. The leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. No longer will there be anything accursed, but the throne of God and of the Lamb will be in it. And His servants will worship Him. They will see His face. His name will be on their foreheads. And night will be no more. They will need no light of lamp or sun, for the Lord will be their light, and they will reign forever and ever. So here's how we close this section. You see two basic things that are brought up. You have the river of life and the tree of life. Well, first, the river of life. In the Old Testament, you'll remember way back in the first book of the Bible, in paradise, in Eden, you had the river that flowed through it. And the idea is that it watered the gardens and everything could grow because there was a tremendous source of water there for it to thrive. Heaven is watered by the stream or the river, and it's flowing from the throne room of God. It's from under the throne of God in the city of God. And does that mean that God's throne is literally perched on top of a bubbling creek of some kind? I don't think so. I think the idea is, what does it represent? The river and water represents life. And from there's this constant flow of this source of water that represents the life of God just gushes forth in heaven. There's an overabundance, if you will, of the water. It oozing out, and His radiance oozes out with it, so that every creature is completely filled with this source of life. He sustains life, and He is the source of life. So all of the goodness is coming from the throne of God, a constant source here. And you see, secondly, the tree of life. It yields its fruit month after month, year after year. So all that we need from God is, again, it's the symbol of abundance. There's absolutely nothing lacking. I would even say an overabundance. An overabundance that there's more than enough for everything to thrive in the way it was designed to thrive in the face of God. You can't exhaust it. You can't. Everybody can go and take from these things and it will never run out. So all of this comes from the throne. And it reminds me of one of the first visions and words of Christ to the churches when we began this book. It said that everything that takes place, every judgment, comes from the command center of the universe. And one of the churches, Christ promised that you will drink of the river of life. You will partake of the tree of life. There's no more the cutting off because of sin. Christ dealt with all that. Everything is downstream of God and the Lamb, the source and the sustenance of life, His goodness, His glory, His energy, His power. So we close with this. What is central? What is the main point about all of these details in heaven? It's God. It's God. That's the main point. Everything that we could comprehend or understand about God, He is there in full measure, and we will reap the benefits because of the work and the person of Christ. That's why we want to worship Him so fervently in this earth, because we understand the ramifications of what He has accomplished. Christ, God, the Lamb, the Lion, is central. There's lots of wonderful things about heaven that we can look forward to. But God is the most important and the most wonderful thing there. I think God plants this in our heads. He uses revelation to give us these seeds of hope, to give us something to long for, to be able to see that this world is not all there is. So how do we apply this? Well, Jesus, in Matthew chapter 6, as He's teaching the people, proclaimed these words. He says, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." Now you see how our heart is tied to heaven. It's not just a material thing. Are we storing up our treasures in heaven? Well, we have to know about heaven. If our hearts are there, we're longing for it, right? What are we investing in this earth that show that our hearts long for the world to come? That our hearts long to bask in the fulfillment of the promises of Christ. In light of this passage, how does our daily routine reveal that we are a people that want to live forever with God? How do our daily habits or our daily routine reveal that we recognize God and God alone as our only source of life and as our daily sustenance? How does our daily routine, the things that we're interested in, the things that we're spending our time and our money, how does that communicate that we are a people that long to be with the triune God in the world to come? What are we investing in? What are we giving ourselves to? In heaven, whatever glory of gifts they have, they just offer them back to God. It's all for God's glory. It's all for God's use. What Jesus is saying here is that even now today, our own hearts are communicating something. We are investing in something. And the warning is the things of this world, chaff. They don't last. But a relationship with God and obedience to God, these are the things that we can offer back to God. Where do our hearts lie? Is God what we want more than anything else? I'll close with Revelation 22:14. Blessed are those who wash their robes so that they may have the right to the tree of life and that they may enter in the city by the gates. He who has ears to hear, Jesus says, let him hear what the Spirit